Good morning, agus fáilte isteach. This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. Since 2014, I have been hosting this radio hour and am honoured to have the opportunity to bring to you interviews, talks and performances which speak to the Irish and Irish American experience. As a historian trained in Ireland, Italy and the US, I have used interviews as a major component of my research, and I am always thrilled and honoured to use the medium of radio to share aspects of educational and ethnic interest. WNYE 91.5 FM is managed and operated by NYC Media, a part of the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Broadcasting throughout the metropolitan area from the 4 Times Square Tower in Midtown Manhattan, it serves the public 24/7 with its schedule of programming. The programming aims to inform, educate, and reflect the diversity of interests that make up New York City's population. I hope you'll enjoy this week's This Irish American Life. On this week's This Irish American Life, I'm really delighted to have an old friend, I would call him, back on the show, someone I have interviewed in the past on This Irish American Life, and I'm really thrilled that I'm back doing it again today and sharing it with you all. I'm speaking about the wonderfully talented Gregory Harrington, who is a concert violinist and a recording artist. Gregory, many of you will know his name. He is a longtime resident of New York City by way of Dublin in Ireland, and he's really carved out for himself a career, a niche, a pathway, which is something to be very proud of in terms of flying the flag, and his capability of combining classical repertoire with Irish influences is just really beautiful. New York City's iconic Carnegie Hall welcomes the world-class violin soloist Gregory for an extraordinary evening of music on February 16th. The one-night-only performance comes exactly 20 years to the day after Greg made his full solo Carnegie debut, becoming the first Irish violinist to ever earn the prestigious honour, and it punctuates Harrington's illustrious career as a Billboard-charting, award-winning artist who has released 6 acclaimed albums, performed across the globe for presidents, vice presidents, and in major stadiums and concert halls for millions of music fans. That evening will celebrate Greg's extraordinary ability to juxtapose classical music alongside jazz, rock, and pop classics in a way that is both accessible to mainstream and classical aficionados. The first half journeys from the romanticism of the violin and piano repertoire of Brahms and Basini to a second half that encompasses the lyrical splendor of his arrangements for strings and percussions from Led Zeppelin and the Cranberries to Dave Brubeck, Astor Piazzolla, Django Reinhardt, Ravel's Bolero, among others. He'll be joined on stage by some of his favorite collaborators, including renowned concert pianist Simon Mulligan, cellist Eleanor Norton, Alan Bisk, and drummer Dustin Kaufman. So I'm actually going to open up a show. Greg has very kindly given me permission to open up this week's This Irish American Life with some of his beautiful, beautiful music. I'm going to share two songs now, pieces of music. The first one is Shenandoah, and the second one is Swallowtail Jig.
So when I shut up, which I will do in a moment, folks, we will go to those beautiful examples of Greg's work. On this week's program, I will be talking to Greg, as I mentioned, and then I'm going to share with you a little bit more about a project that I have been working on in recent months. I gave you a little bit of a hint of it there not too long ago. I talked a little bit about it on this medium, but it's out in the world now, and I'm going to talk to you at more length about it. But first, let's go to Gregory Harrington. He's an extraordinary performer. Enjoy this, folks. And that was Gregory Harrington with Shenandoah. Okay, folks, so now we will turn over to my chat with Greg. And when we finish that, I'm going to share with you another couple of Gregory Harrington tunes. So now let's go to myself and Gregory Harrington, ostensibly discussing his upcoming concert and where his career and pathways have taken him in recent years.
I am delighted to welcome back to the programme Gregory Harrington. Gregory is a Dublin-born violinist. He's been on with me before, and many of our listeners will be familiar with his wonderful sounds and performances. And I'm taking the opportunity today to speak to Greg in the context of his return concert at Carnegie Hall. It's actually the 20th anniversary performance for Greg, and he's the first Irish violinist to have given a full solo debut in Carnegie. So it's timely and wonderful to welcome you back to this Irish American life. Greg, great to have you back, and congratulations on this milestone, as we were just discussing there. How does it feel to be at this point in your career?
Well, wonderful. Well, firstly, well, thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to have the ability to speak to your audience one more time. It's Carnegie is such an esteemed, iconic hall and an iconic venue. And I think, you know, apart from the original or obvious joke of how do you get to Carnegie Hall and the practice, it is really something I'm so very excited about. You know, there's the obvious, you know, as we were talking about earlier, the obvious inspiration and awe that you feel about such a venue of an incredible venue, you know. But there's also a little bit of nostalgia. This is 20 years to the day since my first performance there, my debut. Incredibly proud to be the first Irish violinist to give a full solo debut there. And in the meantime, I've given five. This will be my fifth performance. So twice in the main hall, twice in the recital hall, and it is just such a not only, as I said, beautiful venue, but I think the thing that strikes me most is just, and it happens most of the time, just before you're about to play, there's this moment of the feeling of every idol that I've had has stood right here. And there's just such a sense of incredible history. And I think that's inspirational to every artist that stands on those stages.
Many of our listeners are familiar with your wonderful work and what you've been doing over the last, I suppose, now 2 decades. We're dating you in that sense. Yeah. But for those who are new to your work, Greg, tell us a little bit about your journey, I suppose, from Ireland to New York in this context, and how we meet you today at this moment in your career.
My initial reaction to that is to start when I was 4 years old, but I don't think we've got enough time for that journey as such. I did start when I was four. I was in the RAF Horse Show with my mother, saw a beautiful string quartet play, so taken by the sound of the violin. I tugged her arm. I was about knee high to a grasshopper, pointed at the violin and said, I wanted to play that. She went in the very next day. Fast forward, came out of college, did my auditions for New York, got in to study with a very famous teacher. And then in my second year, I think I did a competition, won the competition, and gave my debut in Carnegie Hall. I think that was sort of my first. I was still a student. So it was my sort of first professional engagement over here. And I think from traveling, and I've sort of been touring and traveling and working and performing ever since. And I think it's been, for me, my journey is a little bit more unique. There is the, you know, because I started out playing. And I still adore playing classical, everything classical, you know, and there was a part of my journey that evolved into a lot of crossover. So for Carnegie, I think the show we have starting off with Brahms that I played with in my London debut in my very, very first concert, as an artist. And then the second half will be things that sort of over the last 10 years that I've had so much traction with and exploration with, you know, whether that's a little bit of the Cranberries Zombie or Johnny Cash or South American Tango or a little bit of Irish traditional music. And it's all basically done through the vein of how I'm perceiving things. So, you know, I've got both cellists and percussion, and it's about creating a soundscape that is just, you want to just try and get something that's just magnetic to the ear, where people just are so drawn to something that they, A, have familiarity with, but B, have the experience of, God, I really feel I've never heard that again, and I love it. So it's been a fascinating journey, really, really fascinating, and one that I look back fondly at. You know, I mean, I look back not in a finality, but hopefully keep going on for a long time more. But yeah, it has been a beautiful journey with lots of ups and lots of downs, and navigating that landscape over the last 20 years here in New York.
how much, you know, and you talk so nicely there. And I think even how your February 16th concert is kind of pitched in terms of mentioning some very classical, I suppose, repertoire might be the right term, and then more modern stuff. I see the Cranberries mentioned in there. And is that really, is that combination in terms of your violinist who's from Ireland but has this, loves the classical, your classical training and drawing on the classical work, but then integrating expectations of Irishness in an American or, you know, kind of global setting? How do you navigate all that, and do you find that fun or do you find that constraining?
The most definitely the latter. It is so fun to create something new or just unexpected. And I think it's because my audience evolved, I actually evolved in the audiences I was performing to. So whether it's, I think it started out, I think corporately actually, whether it was one or two corporate events, and you know, if you get up in a corporate venue and your function is purely entertainment. Now, so you have 15 minutes to absolutely grab everybody in the room and not let them go, or otherwise everybody talks over you if you don't have that. And I found to mix a beautiful opening of Vivaldi's Four Seasons with, let's say, Purple Haze, and finish with Time to Say Goodbye by Bocelli, you get people really unexpectedly saying, I love this, you know, and then that's where that evolved, and people will come up to you afterwards. And so I start writing more and arranging more, and then touring more. And I think I recorded my first Irish album, actually, traditional Irish album, last year. And this was released last year, but it was recorded during the pandemic in the Irish Repertory Theatre. But that was an exploration of traditional Irish through my lens, mixed with contemporary Irish, whether that's U2 or Glen Hansard, mixed with a little of Irish Americana, you know, Shenandoah ballads and whatnot. But it was, you know, it's, I think, how the audience has evolved and reacted has shaped the direction and the choice of repertoire that I do. So, and I do feel that putting Bach with Bob Dylan is a very natural progression, right? Or because you see sometimes how their lineage goes and how they sort of fit in. And I think telling that story and taking the audience on a journey that is not just purely playing, but there's a story behind it, that there's something tangible, and it's not about composer or anything, it's about something that they can really sort of emotionally gravitate towards. And in that way, then the music means something more. Your performance, you have your job then is to just emote. And I think with classical, the focus is always on precision. Such like a dot over a note means something different to a little bar under a note in classical, and it has such a definitive interpretation. With jazz, for example, Miles Davis, and I love doing my Miles Davis stuff, it's just a lead sheet, and then there's really no sets of guidelines, like in the same way classical is, but they both have the same end goal. You have to completely and utterly move the listener. So, and music is a language that you don't need any alphabet. So it's, you know, you either do it or you don't. So I think that fascinates me to go through different genres to get to the same end goal of really creating an incredibly unique experience for the listener.
I'm conscious of time, but just while I have you, you know, I saw, I guess it was on social media and stuff, and following you a little, that you did some really creative stuff during the pandemic in terms of taking advantage of spaces that were quiet and things like that to do some really unique and beautiful performances. How has it been kind of coming back to our quote normality of, you know, navigating post, getting through it all? I mean, I don't want to be bringing up kind of bad memories for you or whatever, but you're still standing on the other side of it. How was it all for you?
Navigating that landscape was difficult. I think the one thing that was lovely, there was a beautiful opportunity. And I think this, you know, of the projects that I did, the one that stood out was doing, there's a beautiful ballad called The Nearness of You. And we did a music video in New York when it was empty. And it's a surreal, eerie feeling being on Times Square where there's normally tens of thousands of people and not having a single soul, or on Sixth Avenue And like, and when we were recording this, like in Washington Square Park, the thing that really struck me was the wildlife that was out, rides around on the streets, animals around. And that was the thing. And this was about a month into the pandemic or a month and a half into the pandemic. So we had this opportunity. But since, you know, and the pandemic itself was actually really hard for every musician, anybody who had a job, whose jobs relied on standing in front of on stages in front of packed houses. So year one was interesting in the sense that musicians were probably built for it more so than other people. We are comfortable with isolation. We're comfortable with practicing on our own. We're comfortable with this solitary life because we've done it. So this was actually nice emotionally to a certain degree. There was the worry, but it was actually things died down. When it opened back for most other people, like year two, that was the harder part for musicians, I feel, because our audiences, our box office is relies on full houses and packed houses. So when the narrative was, yay, everybody's happy, like the houses are open, that's not great when you have 30 people or 30% house, so you cannot pay your musicians so this is, while everybody's delighted that the houses are open again, this isn't financially viable, right? So that was actually, that transition was a lot harder. And now coming out of it, I don't think I was busy for about 20 months, 22 months, something like that. And then last June, it just went mental, and I haven't stopped working since in a very healthy way. But even now when I do concerts with venues, and let's say it's the 200 seat venues size, you know, you're touring around the US, it's very different now. Instead of, there used to be a set fee, now promoters don't necessarily want to take the same financial risk, so that let's say you get a door split. And you could get, you know, you could get something that will not even cover your expenses, or you could get something that you'll do really, really well with. But to take both cellists, you know, in my group on, let's say, for flights, and you're paying $4,000 for flights out to, and for them, because two cellos and two seats, you know, and you might take in $1,500, you might take, but it does, you know, you could cover those mm-hmm. costs, you might not. So now the model has changed where I go and I hire local. So I will source musicians, and I've written a show that's a 2-hour show that can be done on 1 2.5-hour rehearsal. And I will build in a practice fee so that they are completely, they have everything nailed down out when we go to rehearsal. So the model has changed.
Wow.
But I think, like anything, if you don't understand that you need to adapt and you do need to be a lot more creative in how to make it work, then that's what it is. But it's, you mix everything, you blend everything. Your offerings are everything from corporate to concerts to touring. And like any artist, sometimes that isn't, that they earn great, and sometimes you just barely break even. And so it's that there's no linear sort of fee on this. But look, that's the.
But it, you know what, Greg, it's thanks for sharing that. I think as consumers, it's good for us to think about how, I suppose in all our lives we've had changes, and just for you to explain some of the impact. And I suppose in some ways sourcing local talent is a good thing, right?
Yeah.
But it's that sense of adaptation and change that we're going through. It's great to see that you've come out the other side of that.
Yeah.
And I hope that this concert on Thursday, February 16th is, I don't know, marks a new era. I mean, I know this isn't your first performance recently, but, you know, to come out
and
in collaboration with the Irish Repertory Theatre, and I suppose whet our appetites a little bit as we look towards the high holy month of March.
Yeah.
For you to be there in Carnegie Hall flying the flag, it is such an iconic venue. You know, I just a little bit familiar with the history of the place over almost all of its history, Greg, and the role it has played for Irish activists in terms of speaking there and gathering people and a performance space and everything, thinking about the Clancy's playing there. And I saw Greg Glenn Hansard myself a few years ago there and stuff like that. It's just at Rhiannon Giddens was there recently. I saw it's just like there's something about those two words, Carnegie Hall, that is is just wonderful to see. And we're so proud of what you're doing. And we hope that the concert goes well. And for anyone who wants to find out more information about Greg's concert, I suppose the title, it's presented in by the Irish Repertory Theatre, Gregory Harrington Violin. And as you mentioned, you'll be accompanied by someone on two cellists, someone on piano and percussion as well. So it sounds wonderful, Greg. And I only wish I were in New York to be there, but keep doing what you're doing.
Another time indeed.
Absolutely. And thank you for coming on today to give us an update and for us to share this good news of this wonderful event.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. It is always good to chat. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Keep doing what you're doing, Greg. Thanks a lot.
Will do.
And now to close out my chat with Gregory, I'm going to share with you two more of his beautiful pieces of music, the first of it, which is called Oblivion. And to close us out with this portion of Greg's work, Ashokan Farewell. Thank you. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Greg as much as I did speaking to him, and his wonderful artistry on violin is just something beautiful to behold. And it's so great to see that he has navigated his way through COVID. As he talked about, it wasn't an easy time there through it all, and really nice for us to hear about that. And we wish him all the best on his upcoming performance. And I know he's someone that we all want to watch. To close out the programme today, I want to talk to you a little bit about a recent anniversary, which I had the good fortune of celebrating or thinking about up close and personal, I suppose I might say. And that is the 50th anniversary of the entry of Ireland into the EU. And I speak to you about this in the context of a new exhibition, which is called Into Europe, Ireland and the EU, 1973 to 2023. I had the good fortune of working on that project and curating that exhibition, which was recently opened in Dublin by the Taoiseach Micheál Martin, TD, Minister for Foreign Affairs. And it was presented in collaboration with the Royal Irish Academy under the auspices of the Department of Foreign Affairs and the National Archives. So this exhibition will be doing the rounds in the University and Library Network of Ireland, will be travelling around. It's also going to be at some foreign missions and embassies, so you may have an opportunity to see it closer to home. It's currently in San Francisco. I believe it's coming to Washington, D.C., so please do keep an eye out for it, and you can find out some information about it online as well if you put in to your search engine Into Europe, Ireland and the EU. You should be able to pull up the information on that, and they're actually going to publish online the accompanying booklet based on the exhibition's content. I wanted to give you a little bit of a kind of running commentary. So through this medium, I can't show it to you, but I can describe it to you a little in the context of this historical moment. Most people will, practically anyone I know, will agree that Ireland's entry into the EU, which was then, of course, the EEC 50 years ago, really marked a milestone in the development of modern Ireland. And it really came at an important inflection point in terms of coming 50 years after independence. It has shaped Ireland in very profound ways and in very kind of day-to-day, ordinary ways. In a May 1972 referendum, the Irish electorate delivered a clear message that they wanted to be integrated into Europe in this way, voting 83% in favour of entry. Joining was done in a spirit of optimism, with expectations of higher standards of living, better prices for agricultural products, new industrial markets and more jobs. Coming exactly 50 years after independence, Ireland's entry marked the most momentous development in Irish foreign policy and in national sovereignty since the foundation of the Irish state a half century earlier. From being an isolated island on the periphery of Europe with a small economy, for since 1973, Ireland has evolved into one of the most open, globalised and progressive societies in the world. Reinforcing Ireland's connection to its continental neighbours has transformed Irish culture and society, and in the process, Ireland has become a vital and vibrant member of the community of EU member states. As I mentioned, the milestone of a half century gave us cause to reflect on membership and what it has meant to feel a sense of being Irish and European. It's important to remember, folks, that 3.5 million Irish citizens have only ever known Ireland within the EU. And what I do in this exhibition is I explore some of the highlights of membership. Jack Lynch, the Taoiseach at the time, remarked that entry into the PEC marked a most important crossroads. I suppose in ways it's building off that sense of an important crossroads that we are speaking to. This exhibition covers 12 pretty much thematic panels, although the first one or two are chronological in terms of setting the scene and talking about the context of Ireland entering the EU, etc., etc. And I take a magazine-style approach. It's image-heavy. It's driven by photographs. I made a decision with it to lean less into traditional historical documents, which tend to be more static, word-driven documents. I made a decision to make this more image-heavy and image-driven in terms of the content and telling this narrative. The first panel, which is basically an introduction, is followed by the context of the vote, essentially the context of the May 1972 referendum, which was the first constitutional amendment to be approved by Irish voters via a referendum. It was also done in the context when the government of the day could freely campaign on one side, which since 1995, the government is obligated to provide information on both sides of a referendum. Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, and in other interest groups like the Irish Farmers Association campaigned for a yes vote, and the no campaign was much smaller in scale. It was led by Labour, Sinn Féin, some trade unions, and some interest groups like the sea fishing industry. The Taoiseach of the day, Jack Lynch, and Minister for Foreign Affairs, Patrick Hillary, TD, were the public faces of the yes campaign, and they energetically traversed the country promoting accession to interests and sectoral groups. They were in agreement that Ireland's potential would only be fully realised within the confines of the EC, and their aims were to promote the immediate benefits of memberships to the agricultural community through the promised increased prices within the common agricultural policy and the longer term benefit of access to European markets for industrial growth and increasing employment. The vote took place on Thursday, May 10th, 1972, from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 70.88% of a turnout, a very high turnout. And as I mentioned, 83.1% of Irish men and women, some 1.2 million Irish people voted in favour of entry. The Irish public were with Jack Lynch's confidence in the country's ability to hold, and I quote, an equal place in the Europe of tomorrow. So that essentially forms the building block from which I move on in this vein. I then look at the common market context of things. Agriculture and fisheries, of course, are very important. I then take a look at communities together is the next panel, which is essentially looking at the context of what EU membership and peace, in particular in the context of Northern Ireland, has meant. Here I make reference, of course, to John Hume, who once observed that the European Union, it was the best example in the history of the world of conflict resolution. The next panel then looked at Irish Women for Change, is the name of it. A lot has been done in Ireland in terms of equality between genders. It's one of the fundamental principles of EU law. And legislation for equal rights existed from the early days of integration. So women who've come of age in Ireland since 1973 enjoy considerably more rights than their mothers, thanks in large part to Ireland's EU membership. And I explore that a little bit in that panel. You know, it's a subject which is close to my heart as a woman who was born into the EU. You know, I often reflect on the opportunities that I've been afforded, which are different to that of my mother and my grandmother, and what that has meant. it doesn't mean that everything is perfect or hunky-dory. There's lots more to do. But certainly this area brings you in particular into an area of kind of what ifs in Irish history. You know, would that have come about anyway? Would Ireland have enacted equality legislation without the EU? Yes, that is a kind of what if of Irish history, and we don't, as historians, we don't really like to get into that, but it's hard to deny the significance or the positive influence that was felt or and pressure that may have been exerted in the context of membership. The next panel looks at Ireland's place as a sovereign nation and what that has meant in the world, Ireland in the world in that sense. And then they move on to learning, education. Many people, when they think of the EU and education, they think of the Erasmus program, a very, very, very successful program. In terms of study abroad, I think one of the largest programs in the world. And that was interestingly pioneered by someone who was very active in the Irish EU space. And that is, of course, Peter Sutherland. He was one of Ireland's EU commissioners. And he was considered by many to have been the father of Erasmus. So there's a little nugget of information you may not know about. Then moved on to enlarging Europe and what enlargements have looked like, and touching on some of the treaties and how that played out in terms of the EU expanding and Ireland's place in that. Then we come at engaging with the wider world from Ireland in the EU. And then I look at the language, Tír na Teanga, the role of the Irish language, the linguistic influence of Ireland and the EU. And the final 12th panel closes out with a very image heavy, one image of the then Taoiseach Micheál Martin, now the Taoiseach, with Ursula von der Leyen, the President of the European Commission, the two of them in Brussels, and they're walking through the headquarters, passing a photo of Jean Monnet. And Jean Monnet is considered to be one of the fathers of Europe in terms of European integration. And I built a panel around that in the context of COVID-19, Brexit, and Ireland's place as a nation in the EU. That is the sum total of the content of Into Europe, Ireland and the EU 1973 to 2023. You may have an opportunity to engage a little bit more with it, either online or in person. And I hope that you find it interesting and provocative in terms of thinking about this very interesting chapter in Irish history. The true line of it intellectually was exploring how much we have incorporated and adapted the European experiment into our everyday lives in ways that we don't really think about too much, and the contingency and context of identity whereby we can feel like a Dubliner, an Irish person, a European, a citizen of the world, all in one. So it was that contingency and mobility and openness of identity that I kind of wanted to get a sense of. And I also wanted to capture, obviously, the high politics are important in terms of the decisions being made by quote unquote important people that impact on everyday lives. But I also wanted to capture a sense of the everyday nature of how we use our, how we engage with Europe in terms of the currency we use, the passports, the ease of access, the way we can travel, all these different elements which we actually take for granted. And the one important thing there, I mentioned, I look at language. This exhibition is done in a bilingual version. It's done in the English language and it's done in Irish. I felt very strongly that our story in this vein should be told simultaneously, Triangaelga Freshen. So in that way, it also speaks to that diversity and linguistic richness of the island of Ireland, even within the EU. Okay, folks, well, listen, I think I've given you enough of a history lecture there. I hope I've whetted your appetite a little bit. And to close out this show, folks, it's 6 months since our late great friend Mick Maloney passed away. I'm currently recording some memories of Mick, which I'm having, and it's a real pleasure to do. But I've been thinking about him a lot. I've been picking up photographs of him and engaging with his memory and legacy a little bit. Just wanted to close out the show with a nod to him. If you listen to me regularly, you know this tune is a favourite of mine. It's Kilkelly. This is a great song, and Mick did a great rendition of it. And I want to close out this Irish-American life and say slán with Kilkelly. Thanks, folks. Have a great week.
Kilkelly, Ireland, 1860, my dear and loving son John. Your good friend, schoolmaster Pat McNamara, so good as to write these words down. Your brothers in law got to find work in England. The house is so empty and sad. The crop of potatoes is sorely infected, a third to a half of them bad. And your sister Bridget and Patrick O'Donnell are going to be married in June. Mother says not to work on the railroad, be sure to come on home soon. My dear and loving son John. Hello to your missus and to your four children. May they grow healthy and strong. Michael has got a wee bit of trouble. I suppose that he never will learn. Because dampness, there's no turf to speak of, and now we have nothing to burn. And Bridget is happy, you name the child for her, though she's got six of her own. You say you found work, but you don't say what kind. When you'll be coming home. Your dear old mother has gone. We buried her down at the church in Kilkelly. Brothers and Bridget were there. Don't have to worry, she died very quickly. Remember her in your prayers. And it's so good that Michael's returning with money, he's sure to buy land. For the crop has been poor and the people are selling any price that they can. Son John. I suppose that I must be close on 80. It's 30 years since you've gone. Because of all of the money you sent me, I'm still living out of my own. Michael has built himself a fine house, and Bridget's daughters are grown. Thank you for sending your family picture, your lovely young women and men. You say that you might even come for a visit, a joy to see you again. Dear Brother John, I'm sorry I didn't write sooner to tell you that Father passed on. He is living with Bridget. She says he was cheerful and helped me right down to the end. I should have seen him playing with the grandchildren. Pat McMurray, your friend. And we buried him alongside of Mother down at Kilkelly churchyard. He was a strong and a feisty old man, considering his life was so hard. And it's funny the way he kept talking about you, he called for you at the end. Oh, why don't you think about coming to visit? We'd all love to see you again.
This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records.